You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Good morning, Vancouver. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. My name is Catherine Gear Chambers, and I am the current president of CITR Student Executive. I am so excited that you are joining us this morning for a special broadcast that is part of the annual 24 Hours of Student Power, a celebration of the fantastic work that the UBC student community and community at large is doing. This hour, you have the opportunity to listen to a conversation that I had last week with two members of the UBC Social Justice Center, Ishmam and Gabby. We talk about the movement to defund the police, the housing crisis, the difficulties, but also the importance of engaging in activism during a pandemic, and the relationship between education and social justice. This was a conversation that we had over Zoom, so you might be able to pick up on some of that. Of course, we want to keep everything social, distanced, and safe. But it was an absolute privilege to hear and learn from these two phenomenal community organizers. And I am so glad that you are joining us right now to be part of this really important conversation. Just like as a formal introduction, my name is Catherine, pronouns she, her, hers, and I'm the current president of the CITR Student Executive. And we're doing this for 24 Hours of Student Power, which is like an annual event where we highlight the work of UBC students in the UBC community. And this year, especially, our amazing spoken word people has a fantastic idea that we focus on student empowerment and social justice. So I'm really excited that we can talk to you. Do you want to just sort of introduce yourselves and your role in the UBC community and in the Social Justice Center?
My name is Ishmam. I use he, him pronouns. I'm a third year student, and I organize with the Social Justice Center. I entered this work through organizing around housing justice predominantly, and here we are.
I'm Gabby. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I'm calling in from unceded Musqueam territory. I just graduated from UBC, actually. I studied environmental science and human geography, and I'm also an organizer with the SJC. And I have been, I guess, for 2 years now, maybe. Yeah, started out doing some climate justice work, and then things kind of evolved from there.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you both for joining me. Could you tell me just sort of a little bit about what the purpose of the Social Justice Center is at UBC, and what you what needs you hope that the center can meet in the community?
Sure. So the Social Justice Center is a resource group. We operate with a few other resource groups that are directly funded by the AMS, including the Student Environment Center, the Pride Collective. I think they're called Color Connected Against Racism, and the Women's Center. And we work towards transformative change, justice, and liberation through a survivor-centric harm reduction, radical feminist, decolonial, anti-oppression framework. And the Social Justice Center is a consensus-based organization, and we like to emphasize in our organizing the idea of being prefigurative, which to us means embodying the way or kind of the worlds that we're trying to build in the process of organizing. Our mantra at the Social Justice Center is the how is the why. And so we are emphatic about stressing relationships, about being kind, about building communities that are devoid of oppression while we do the important work of envisioning a future that is just for all.
Fantastic. Thank you. So what are some noticeable actions that UBC Social Justice Center has taken in the community, or like how might people recognize your name if they've been a student at UBC or a member of the community?
So some of the things that we've been doing in the past couple of years, we helped to organize the climate strike, which was the hugest or the largest mobilization in UBC history last year. We did that with a bunch of amazing, amazing other folks, folks at UBC C350, or they're now called Climate Justice UBC, and also the Climate Hub. And that was just like a fantastic, I think, demonstration of student power, and also a fantastic mobilization for climate justice. We also, as Ishmael was saying, we organize around housing justice. So working with folks in the downtown east side, working with folks who are living at tent cities and in single room occupancy hotels. So we've done some work in like feeding those folks and providing resources to them, and just like helping them out. We've helped them kind of like bring their concerns to court when they were facing eviction. And we've done a lot of kind of like advocacy work with a bunch of different organizations to kind of bring their voices to city council, and to highlight their needs to city council. We've done that city council advocacy work around housing justice, but also most recently we collaborated with a bunch of groups to do that advocacy work to try to defund the police or make steps towards defunding the police in Vancouver. We've also done some work to like mobilize folks for getting out the vote. We've also done some work around solidarity with land defenders. So again, together with the amazing folks at Climate Justice UBC, we held like a sit-in at David Eby's office for Wet'suwet'en Strong to again be in solidarity with land defenders. What are the other things we've done? The other thing about the SJC is that because we're positioned as a resource group, we have ties to the AMF and we're kind of a check for them. So we're able to hold them accountable and build relationships with them in ways that can really push them to advocate for student needs and to advocate for the needs of the folks in the UBC community in general. So last year we also held a justice forum so that the like prospective candidates, I guess, for the AMF could kind of, we could like grill them a little bit and hold them accountable to the things that they said. We like kind of helped with some COVID mutual aid things earlier in the summer, trying to again meet people's needs in an incredibly stressful time especially during the early days of the pandemic. We've had like banner drops and lots of fun. Did I miss anything?
I think you covered it. The things that we're working on right now have to do predominantly with the BPD, which I think could be something that we talk about in more detail, and also with the tent city, which is currently at Strathcona Park. We've been trying to be good allies to organizers and residents of the current Strathcona Park tent city, which they've called the Kennedy Trudeau tent city, to highlight the inaction from our municipal and our federal governments that have led to the conditions or like a housing crisis in which the best option for people is living in a tent. This is the third iteration of this tent city. It was originally at Oppenheimer Park, the BCNDP government, which, you know, we are told is the best that we can get, the best possible government that BC will ever have, essentially put the tent city through what was a soft removal, a process in which they called it an effort to house people, but simultaneously criminalized the existence of people at the park, which was awful, like a really awful way of removing people, extremely sneaky and just disingenuous. And it also gave people who were kind of on the fence about this issue, and it gave them an opportunity to say, hey, look, they're being given housing. And then they were able to turn a blind eye to the fact that there were spikes going up or fences with spikes going up at Oppenheimer Park. The park then moved to Crab Park, where there was an actual cordon junction, and now it's at Strathcona Park, and there's been a media circus around demonizing people who live at the park. It's just awful, and there's like the mainstream media in Vancouver has gone wild with these awful narratives, and it's just gotten worse. And the other thing that we're working on right now is defunding the police. And maybe this is something that we can talk about in more detail, but in July, the SJC organized an effort to around a motion tabled by Councillor Swanson, who is an ally of the SJC and in my mind, an extraordinary public servant. And Councillor Swanson brought forward a motion to deprioritize policing and instead spend money on community-based harm reduction and public safety initiatives. Council unanimously passed this motion, which did several things. It asked the VPD to itemize their spending. It asked councils or the city staff to seek input from groups that are uniquely positioned to speak on a just future for our city, including Black Lives Matter, WISH, CCAP, or the Carnegie Community Action Project, the Hogan's Alley Society, the Downtown Eastside Women's Center, the Vancouver Alliance, or the VANDU. It also asked the staff to prepare a report and budget to deprioritize policing and direct the mayor to inform the VPD that it's council's priority to deprioritize policing. Anyway, this motion passed unanimously, and because of COVID and cutbacks to the city's budget, the current 2021 proposed budget allocates absolutely no funding to the motion that was passed, which is extremely undemocratic and really shows how behind council is with the times. We're in the middle of a global uprising and movement against police violence and anti-Blackness and systemic violence in institutions that we're supposed to trust or told we should trust. And so that's what we're organizing around right now, to make sure that our city, or that city council, recommits to commitments that were made in July, and that the city got a lot of international attention for. It was widely seen as a massive victory, and it's quite disappointing to see our city take steps back on this.
I'm just gonna like hop on to some of the things that you said, Ishvan. The two main things I wanted to like tack on to what you said were with the motion that the SJC organized, and that again a lot of folks in the city organized around in the summer. I also wanted to mention that, in my view, the only reason that this decision was unanimous is because all of the organizers in the city pushed so that there was a record-breaking 395, I want to say, speakers that signed up to speak at council, and there were hundreds and hundreds of letters that were sent to council members. And so what we're seeing is, or what we saw in the summer, was this massive mobilization that helped get these commitments into play, I guess. And what we're wanting to see now is a continuation of the momentum so that these commitments actually are brought into play. And then the other thing that I wanted to say is that I think it's also really important that that we are able to kind of connect the dots between the two things that Ishan was talking about. So the criminalization of poverty and of folks who are living in tent cities, for instance, and the massive amounts of spending that are going to the police are really, really connected. And so what we're pushing for is a city that is grounded in these principles of justice, in these principles of liberation, and that involves both defunding the police and giving that money to get people into homes without evicting them and without forcing them to go places, or without displacing them and without kind of infringing on their self-determination.
Yeah, thank you for that. I've definitely appreciated the work that you've been doing around this issue in particular. So like, you've talked about a lot of issues in terms of like land defenders, the defunding the police, and I'm just wondering, considering the fact that the UBC community is like in one way kind of isolated on Point Grey, kind of out of touch of the rest of Vancouver, but then also considering who attends UBC is connected like to communities all around the world, and especially right now during COVID, there are people who are physically located not only all over Vancouver and the Lower Mainland, but also all over the world. So I'm wondering, like, as you've clearly been talking about, a single issue takes so much work to pay attention to and to draw attention to. How do you choose which issues to focus on?
That's a great question, and a difficult one to answer, because it's something that we struggle with. There are so many things that we can choose to focus our attention on, but it's important for us to keep in mind what our capacity is. But I think your point about geography is extremely important. We do live in an extremely privileged part of Vancouver. You can walk anywhere on campus, and within 10 minutes, you'll see massive mansions that are multi-million dollars. I haven't done campus organizing for a very long time, but I think there's a general culture of existing in a bubble, and doing things that only affect students on campus. And I think that traditionally the AMS has only prioritized issues that matter to students. I'll give you a particular example. When we hosted the Justice Forum, or co-hosted the Justice Forum, which was a debate for people who were running for AMS elections last year, one of the candidates for VP admin said that if he was elected, would crack down on homeless people in the space. I don't remember exactly what the comments were, but they were extremely anti-homeless. And I think the general view here is that this purpose of student organizations should be just to help students, whereas it's important for us to recognize at the SJC that we are extremely privileged to have the resources that we do here at this university, and that because we live within a bus ride from the downtown east side and tent cities in Vancouver, which are literally kind of battlegrounds between poor people and people who are victims of decades of failed policies, and the Vancouver Police Department and the Fire Department and other oppressive institutions, that it's important for us to just recognize our privilege and use it accordingly. It's been difficult to do that with a world in which democracy is falling apart just south of the border, where there's also fights against police violence in countries like Nigeria right now. And so it's difficult for us to pick our issues. And so we're trying to do our best. But I think just because we live in Vancouver, it's generally conducive to our ability to do this work sustainably, to focus on our city and just our neighborhoods and our communities, which are deeply unequal, which are deeply unjust. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the last question about the VPD, which I think kind of ties into this, just recognizing the depth of injustice that exists in our backyards, essentially. If you go on the Vancouver Police Department's Twitter, on their Facebook, you can essentially see like every single thing that they put out is an attempt to demonize poor people, attempt to demonize people who are, again, who've been victimized by unjust policies, by over-policing, by just the immense amount of injustice that exists in our communities. Speaking to the low-level crime, Vancouver has seen a drop in crime over the past few years, but the VPD is using things like increased perception of crime, which is really just a function of the fact that the media has chosen to demonize poor people. This is an extremely powerful police department. It's created a new unit for low-level crime, and it's essentially decided not to make budget cuts mandated by the city. So the VPD has an extreme amount of decision-making power in our city. And so we choose to do local organizing because we understand that we are privileged in being situated where we are. And with that privilege comes the responsibility of looking out for our neighbors. The SJC does have a working group and a campaign around international solidarity, which recently has looked like standing in solidarity with Palestine, and in the past has looked like events around migrant justice, and yeah.
Some of the questions that I think about when I think about your question, or some of the things that come to mind, are thinking about what are the needs that we're hearing in our communities and in our city? What are the calls to action that we're seeing? And what are the needs that we're able or well-positioned to fill? And so what I think Ishwam is speaking to is that at the SJC, we think that it is incredibly, incredibly important to be grounded and situated in these local issues that matter to the folks that are in the city. But we, I guess, in the context of COVID, where folks are located all across the world, I would also, I guess, encourage folks to think about the issues that are central to the communities that they're part of, wherever they might be.
Thank you both for your answers. So you both, and like Ishwam, you're talking a lot about how UBC students and students at UBC are like very privileged, obviously, partly just like being at university is a position of privilege, but also the demographic of students who attend UBC and who live in Vancouver tend to be people who do have a lot of privilege. But then on top of that, like students are, again, like I feel like especially at UBC, struggling so much with mental health. And there is definitely like a push and a need to have a conversation around wellness while at university, and especially schools like UBC that are very big and kind of alienating institutions. So I'm wondering how do you balance the urgency of a call to action, especially to students who have so much privilege and who need to recognize their privilege and recognize how they can inherently be upholding systems of injustice, and also recognizing that because they have privilege, they have the ability to speak and to send emails and to take to the streets. But then also, like, how do you balance that with caring for students' wellness and making sure that they feel heard and cared for and that this isn't something that's causing them further stress and anxiety?
That's a really good question. Maybe I'll start, and then Ishwam, again, can fill in the blanks and stop me when I start rambling. So I think like Ishram was saying, one of the really, really key parts for me in the SJC is that we're trying to center care and center giving and receiving care in the work that we do. So centering community care. And so what we're trying to do is build a space where we can hold each other and support each other through the trouble and through the exhaustion and through all of the problems that we might be facing. And so because what we're doing is like process-based organizing, the way that we do it matters. Because of that, we're also trying to emphasize the importance of like rest and healing and doing those things in community or in a community where someone can be like, hey, Gabby, are you taking the time that you need for yourself to like sleep and eat and drink water? Are you taking care of yourself? Because I care about you and you need to do those things. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make our space a space of healing and also a space where folks can come in and receive or come into a collective sense of empowerment and hope and community and joy. And that's not just kind of fueled by anger and bitterness, which a lot of this work can be, but it's because it's a place where we're trying to, again, be prefigurative in our organizing and build the world that we want to see, that it can't just be driven by anger. It also has to be driven by a sense of love and joy. And so I guess the way that I think of it is that we're trying to build within the SJC a collective responsibility to grow and nurture each other and to heal together or alone, but to support each other in our healing and to really center joy in the work. And that can be really, really difficult at times, but it's something that we're trying to do together, I guess. And I guess the other thing that I'll say that we're thinking about is we're thinking about how to make our movement sustainable. So we're trying, but very often we're failing to kind of try to undo a culture of burnout that is so ingrained in UBC as a whole and also in movement spaces as a whole. And to, again, try to make these generative spaces where people can bring their whole selves no matter kind of what they're feeling. What we're trying to build is a space that welcomes everyone and that can kind of meet people where they're at, and a space where, again, we can heal together or hold each other while we heal. And that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to build systems where we can care for each other and build systems that can care for people, where people don't end up, unhoused and, frankly, dead because they're facing poverty or because they're facing criminalization or because they're facing climate change or because they're facing, all of the issues that we're talking about.
Yeah, to add on to Gabby's last point, I think that we often overlook the fact that students are also victims of not being able to need basic material conditions that are kind of conducive to learning at school. Students at UBC are affected by homelessness, by a toxic drug supply. Students at UBC are victims of violence. And so in doing this work of building a more just society in which everybody has housing, everybody has healthcare, we have a safe supply of drugs to make sure people aren't dying from overdoses, we're also hopefully doing this work for students. Students are also often don't have material needs, especially in a system in which public education isn't subsidized, in which we have to pay to go to school. And hopefully that changes. But while the system exists as it does, we have to also connect the fact that students have to pay for school with the fact they very likely are also affected by these issues that we're trying to address in the city more widely. We don't exist in a bubble, and we're all also members of the city, of the province, of the country, all of which are so deeply broken.
Thank you. I appreciate both of your answers, because yeah, this is something that I think about as well. And I've talked to a lot of friends about how universities are part of sort of the capitalist, really fast-paced system that they then shoot us into. And it's kind of intentionally built to discourage resistance because we're always so exhausted. So what you're saying about grounding that work in joy and healing, and also, as you were saying, Ishmael, like connecting it to the issues that we face, like that is definitely one solution where we can like inherently resist the systems that are trying to take that power away from us. I was very curious to hear about how you're managing to do that community work and community building during like COVID, when we are separated from each other, because at least in my experiences, those moments of sort of joy and rejuvenation in social justice work sometimes happen in like those in-person conversations while you're out on a march or like on a picket line or just in conversation at a cafe. So when we're all spread out and feeling quite alienated, how are you able to find those moments of healing and connection?
It's definitely been difficult. And I think you're absolutely right. Because we emphasize relationship building, it's extremely difficult to do that over hour-long meetings on Zoom. And we are continually trying to adjust the ways in which we organize to make sure that people remain motivated, that we don't lose steam in these struggles for justice. We try to have fun at the SJC. We try to do things that we called community care sessions. The last one, we played soccer while being socially distanced. But this pandemic has definitely not made it easy to do the work that we do and organize communities. And we're trying to do our best. And if Gabby, you have an answer, if you, Catherine, have an answer, that'd be great. But I don't know the answer to that. It's definitely been a struggle. And hopefully we can pull our communities as close together as possible and make it through this thing so that we can get back to being in person and having conversations in our space, which really is where most of my fondest memories of the SJC are. Being at a sit-in at David Eby's office, being extremely, extremely, extremely cold at the intersection of UB, or holding the intersection in front of the UBC sign on campus in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en people. Those are my fondest memories, and memories like those keep me motivated to do this work, and I hope to have more soon.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Crimes and Treasons Radio, this is Rick Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM.
Yes, yes, you and I rock with the best, 101.9 CITR Radio. Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy Just Blaze. Right now you're rocking with Jules Andre Brown, Rolly Wells, Jamal Steels, and Horsepower. You know what it is, all right?
Yo, it's Iron Sue, man. I want to shout out Crimes and Treasons Radio, man. CITR 101.9, man. Turn up, turn up, turn up.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Welcome back. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is a special broadcast, part of 24 Hours of Student Power, and we are in the middle of a conversation with the UBC Social Justice Center about the importance of activism, the relationship between social justice and education, and the importance of grounding our activism in healing, love, and community. We're glad that you're joining us and hope that you enjoy the rest of this conversation. I know that you're talking a lot about email campaigns and definitely engaging in social justice work on social media, but I'm curious about how you are approaching this work during the pandemic and also encouraging UBC students to stay involved and to stay active and to move beyond simply having a conversation or posting about it, which is really super important work. I'm just curious to hear about what some of your conversations are about how to engage in activism in a safe way during a pandemic.
So we recognize that doing the work of building communities is more than sending email templates. So over the last year, to whatever extent we've been able to, we've made sure to actually go down and build relationships with people at the tents, the various tent cities. We are in contact with one of the organizers who works for CCAP, the Carnegie Community Action Project, a frontline organization whose mandate it is to protect people in the downtown east side, to help meet material needs for people living at the tent city while building the political kind of muscle to make sure that the tent city is protected from the Vancouver Police Department, from the city council, from the province. It's difficult to do that during the pandemic, especially because a lot of our resources and our intention are focused in the downtown east side. And because the people in the downtown east side are especially vulnerable due to COVID, we have to be careful about going there. We're doing our best, I think.
Thank you. Yeah. It's interesting to hear your take on that, because it is like always going to be a complicated topic, I think. So you're obviously located at UBC and are part of the UBC community. And I think that, at least in my experience of some of my courses at UBC, it does offer a space for some professors or for some people to talk about social justice and to like begin the conversation, which then hopefully does turn into activism. But I'm curious to hear a little bit about your thoughts on the relationship between education and social justice and what it's like being a social justice organization located on a university campus.
Some of the things, I guess, that come to mind in thinking about education and social justice together is, for me, social justice needs education. I think education and knowledge sharing broadly is a really key part of how we learn about the world and how we explain the world for ourselves, how we understand ourselves as part of the world or situated in the world, how we understand the work that we do. And so I guess the way that I think about how the two are related for me is that the learning that I've done at UBC and the unlearning that I've done through my classes, for instance, has been like really, really key to kind of denaturalizing systems of oppression and the structures that surround us and kind of demystifying the way that power operates. And so education has been, I think, or is a really key way to kind of help us question these things and realize that current ways of organizing society and the current systems of oppression and current violence and current harms, they're not a given and they're not inevitable. And so I really think that education is kind of a space where we can envision beyond current systems and think about alternative futures that are grounded in justice and liberation and kind of imagine and embody and bring about new ways of being together. And so education, I think, is really important for kind of broadening our individual kind of imaginaries of what is possible and broadening our collective imaginaries of what is possible. And the other part that I wanted to say about education is that I think it's also really important because it teaches us that we're not alone in this work. There are folks who have been doing liberation work for generations upon generations, and we're not starting from zero. We're starting, the work that we're doing builds on what other folks have again been doing for generations, what folks are doing across the whole planet. And it, I guess, for me, is a really empowering thing to realize, because it's also not all like on one person. It is a collective responsibility. Being like an on-campus student-led organization is helpful because it brings us in kind of close proximity to sites of knowledge exchange. And those can be sites of really, really deep learning and really deep unlearning of the ways that these systems of oppression have been kind of ingrained in some of us.
As people who have access to an incredible amount of knowledge and the opportunity to share that knowledge, the onus is also on us to connect that our theoretical understandings of systems of oppression to material conditions of people who are affected by them. So if we're not doing anything with that knowledge, the knowledge is essentially useless. And so at the SJC, we do the work of organizing, which to me means recognizing our privilege and then using it to not just speak out on issues, but also to be there for other people who are in the struggle. That's the distinction to me between an activist and an organizer. An activist talks about an issue, whereas an organizer understands that this is about taking knowledge that exists in our communities and making sure that material needs are met. So again, if we are entirely theoretical in the work that we do, I don't see a purpose for our existence. We have to connect the knowledge that we have access to, the knowledge that we're sharing, to this struggle for the improvement of people's lives materially. If we talk about homelessness, if we talk about the housing crisis, if we talk about the lack of protections for renters, if we talk about the lack of oversight over the real estate industry, if we talk about systemic racism in a theoretical sense and don't address that in our communities, we're essentially useless. So what we're doing at the SJC is making sure that we are very conscious and intentional about making that connection. And education is step one, and actually doing things in our communities is step two.
The other piece that is really, really important when we talk about education in the context of social justice is that we also make sure that we're not like privileging academic knowledge over other forms of knowledge that are grounded in lived experience and grounded in community, because those, I guess, ways of looking at the world and those ways of being are really, really informative, and they shouldn't be devalued because they're not like formalized in an educational or like in like an institutional setting. And so I think we have, again, as Ishwan was saying, a responsibility to leverage the kind of scholarship that we're learning through university or through our classes and our work on our schoolwork. But that can't be separate from the work that we're doing in community and from the learning that we're doing from our community members, from our own lived experiences.
Absolutely. And I'm glad that you brought up that point about sort of prioritizing academic knowledge or for other forms of knowledge, because I know that's like a conversation that is definitely happening in terms of the general discussion around decolonizing universities and systems of learning. Because that it is like a problem when all of the academic, like maybe even sources that you want to include in an article are all like older white men. And like, how do you then like decolonize the process of learning if certain systems of knowledge aren't even recognized as valid and can't even be used in an undergraduate paper? I was thinking about that, but I appreciate you bringing that up. And it also connects to my next question, which is sort of about UBC as like an academic institution in particular, because like, of course, as we know, UBC is located on the ancestral and unceded lands of the Han Kamenim speaking Musqueam people. And there are ways that the university acknowledges this. There are also many ways that it erases this history. And I was interested in hearing your perspective about where you see UBC succeeding in addressing social justice issues, such as decolonizing the curriculum or the process of learning in general, creating safer spaces and being an accessible institution, and then where you also see UBC failing.
I think the very first thing that comes to mind is that most of the work that UBC has done to like quote unquote address social justice comes after years of work from students, staff, faculty, community members, members of the Musqueam Nation, etc. And I really don't think that UBC as an institution would be doing anything at all if it weren't for the mobilizing efforts and the constant work from these folks. Just like a huge, huge shout out and like a whole bunch of gratitude to the folks who are doing that work. The other thing that I will say about this that I think is important to reflect on is that the rhetoric that I usually see coming from UBC as an institution is that it is that UBC as an institution kind of like all acknowledges past harms or acknowledges histories of harm, for instance, like a colonial history, or they do like land acknowledgements, which are some of the ways that we can see that they're trying to address social justice, but they often don't go any further than that. And they fail to recognize kind of the ways that universities as a whole perpetuate and reify these systems of oppression, and that the violence, for instance, of settler colonialism is ongoing. There's an ongoing genocide, and it is something that the university contributes to. And it's my understanding of UBC is that it is a colonial institution. And so it's not gonna become decolonial in one semester. Those are some of the thoughts that come to mind. But I'm also like thinking about the ways that UBC is failing its students while kind of like upholding an image of itself as like this great like institution. And so some of the things that come to mind are the constant tuition increases, even in the middle of a pandemic where folks are really, really struggling. And it's really ridiculous that tuition keeps increasing in general, and even in a pandemic. There are cops on campus. It's really ridiculous that there are cops on campus when there have been these global uprisings against police violence that are led by Black and Indigenous folks. Some other things that I've heard on campus is that there is generally a lack of support for Indigenous students, staff, and faculty, and a lack of support for Black students, staff, and faculty, and community members. And so the things that I see usually coming out of UBC's administration is a lot of tokenism and a lot of like inclusion on a surface level without changing the underlying conditions and without changing the way that the institution works as a whole. I think it's really important that the whole kind of UBC community is really careful that we're not being placated by what the administration is saying, and that we keep pushing so that we can also have like a more just university that isn't governed, like you said, by these like capitalist relations.
Just to add on to what Gabby said, I think that one tendency that I've noticed from the university is to prioritize, like in the process of addressing injustices that exist on campus, they've prioritized their public perception of the university instead of the important things, which was like how the university changes. And take the example of the climate emergency response from the university. This is a thing that's been going on for a year now, after years of organizing from UBC through C350, which is now called Climate Justice UBC, who pushed the university to commit to divesting from fossil fuels and to declare a climate emergency. So the university started a process called the UBC Climate Emergency Response Process, in which they created a task force, they created multiple subgroups, but a majority of that effort was in working with Argyle, which is a public relations firm. So instead of consulting with communities on campus, the Musqueam Nation, with poor students on campus, students who are victims of other forms of violence, the university's climate emergency response was almost entirely a PR stunt, or like a lot of it's been co-opted as a PR stunt. And it's really just like, in my view, been an insult to the labor of organizers from groups like the Climate Justice UBC, people, Michelle Marcus, for example, who's a friend of the SJC, is an organizer with Climate Justice UBC and was made the chair of the climate task force, does incredible work. But I don't know, I like the entire process and how the university's administration has responded to this task force, and the response has been disheartening. We need to make sure that the university's priorities are not on public perception, and really stop giving a shit about where the university ranks on the Times list of universities. Who the hell cares if we're number 40 or number 34? What matters is if we're investing our money in ethical ways. What matters is that our relationship with the Musqueam Nation is healthy, and that we are supporting students who are affected by climate change.
Yes, thank you for all of that. I actually didn't know that about UBC's climate emergency consulting with a PR firm, but I'm not at all surprised. That's very on brand. Sort of exactly along the lines that you've been talking about, UBC, and like Ishmael, you're just talking about how it's like very bureaucratic and it's hard to make changes. And Gabby, you're talking about how even the changes that like they have made have come after so many years of activism. And like UBC is a huge university and it's very hard to access. It's just, it feels like being part of a big business, or like being a very small fish in a corporate institution. And I feel like it's very difficult to put pressure on the university to make change when you don't even know who to send an email to, you don't know who's in charge of any decision making, and when these processes are so bureaucratic. And I think also when students just feel alienated and isolated from the university itself. So I was wondering what thoughts you have about how to engage in activism with the university and to put pressure on the university, considering how like daunting that is.
I think step one is to make sure that our student government is a student union again. I think that over the past, I don't know, decade or so, the role of a student, like the student body that's in charge, has changed from a radical student union to like a student government that is managerial in its nature. If we take a look at SFU, for example, they've shifted that back. Their current leadership of the SFU Student Society is extremely radical. They're calling for tuition freezes, and they're doing the actual work of organizing their communities. If we don't have radical student unions, if the student unions aren't on the student sides and they're, you know, policing homeless people in our student spaces, what the fuck is the point? So I think that's step one. I think step two is making sure that we're adequately funding organizations on campus that are doing this work. For example, the Climate Justice UBC, as far as I know, doesn't receive any funding from the university. Instead, the university is spending money on things like parties, on the bottom floor of the nest, investing incredible amounts of money on maintaining these spaces, when really what students want are the university to take meaningful action on climate change, for the university to make sure that it's not gouging its students for money. The university isn't taking donations from the fossil fuel, or isn't investing its money in the fossil fuel industry, into real estate, into police departments, into arms contracts, things like that. And also that the university is also increasing funding for spaces like the SASC, for the Climate Hub, which is extremely overworked, and hopefully resource groups as well. And I think it's important for us to have enough money to actually pay students to do this organizing. So I think there needs to be like a radical shift in how we view student actors on campus, because the university administration like is not on our side, and it's time for us to recognize this. And I think we need to listen to groups like, or take lead from the SFU Student Society, which is doing an incredible amount of work. Their president last year, Giovanni Hoseng, just incredible organizer, and their new president, Osab Mohammed, also incredible organizer, and their entire team, which is extremely inspiring to see them reclaim a student union and use it to fight the university, which claims that kind of freezing tuition is pie in the sky type demand. We need pies in the sky. Pies are great. And it's time for our student unions to reject that type of pessimism from our university's administration and really take a more radical approach on campus.
I think the other thing that I would say that is maybe a bit tangential, but I think it's also really important for us to connect the issues that students are facing on campus with the issues that folks in so-called Vancouver as a whole are facing and folks all over the world are facing. And so it's not an isolated problem, I guess is what I want to say. It is a systemic problem.
Yeah, thank you. And on sort of the note that you just mentioned that UBC students should recognize that, although we are sort of isolated, that we are part of this network and we're part of a community and connected to Vancouver and communities beyond Vancouver. The sort of last question that I had that definitely sort of loops back to what we were talking about earlier around issues of defunding the police and other activist movements and like housing activism that's going on in Vancouver. How would you sort of encourage students to approach, I think that you did sort of touch on this in terms of emphasizing the difference between an activist and an organizer in terms of those conversations with the communities and with like engaging with communities in particular, but how do you encourage students to approach this kind of activism and organizing like from a point where they can recognize their privilege but are not acting as like a savior and sort of stepping in as a savior, just like doing this work kind of to like alleviate their own sense of guilt, which absolutely is there and, you know, is a valid feeling, but definitely shouldn't be the sole source of an action. How do you approach like those conversations and activism and action itself? From that perspective of recognizing the privilege that students, especially UBC students, have.
I think that a big part of this is building relationships with the communities that we're intending to serve. There's a saying in the Downtown East Side, nothing for us without us. My answer to this has two parts. Part A, building these relationships, listening to what these people have to say. What are the things that they need to be met? What are their demands? How can we position ourselves? What resources do we have to bring to the struggle to advance it? And part B is to recognize that we are extremely privileged and to always, always sit with the fact that there are people who live in this much pain that is entirely avoidable and entirely open and subject to change.
Some other things that I will offer on this question is that I think it's really, really important that we all do kind of the reflection work of thinking about where we're situated and what power and what privilege we hold And if we are, or if you are a person who holds a lot of power and privilege, a really important part of this work is decentering yourself and giving space for folks who are on the front lines, and not taking up that space, and offering what support that we can without taking up space. And so we're trying to center the issues and not ourselves. And so what is important is committing to learning from folks, committing to being in right relationship with folks who are directly impacted, who are on the front lines, again, because they've been doing this work often for generations. And so it's really, really important when we're doing that, that we're listening with truth and with honesty and with an open mind and being self-reflexive, so that we're always trying to learn and unlearn. And I think for me, the way that I kind of think about justice is that it is about, or one part of it is that it's about being in right relationship. And so I think it's also really crucial that we're reflecting on our motives when we're trying to build these relationships, and we're trying to, I guess, like do things to foster, again, love and care and joy and fight for collective liberation rather than for personal attention or individual clout. That I think is a really important piece. Another thing that I think is really important when we're come to this work without the attitude of being a savior is coming with the realization that anti-oppression work and social justice work and organizing is lived. It's not just something that it's thought about, and it is ongoing. And so it doesn't just mean showing up to a protest like once a month or however many times. It's the work that that builds relationships and builds community and builds worlds to tear down these systems. And so another, I think, really important piece of that is kind of like pluralizing our conception of what building power looks like, of what organizing looks like, and valuing the invisible labor that goes into making this work happen and into supporting folks, especially because that labor is often racialized or gendered. And so we're also thinking about making a lot of different forms of labor and a lot of different forms of organizing be seen as valued.
In the context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies.
Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has an naloxone kit. If you're able to, get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately. Start rescue breathing and administer naloxone if you have it. You cannot get in trouble for being on drugs, so always call 911 in an emergency.
For more information about naloxone kits and training, visit towardtheheart.com.
Thank you and stay safe.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional and unceded territories of the Hankamunim-speaking Musqueam people. This has been a conversation with Ishmael and Gabby from the UBC Social Justice Center. We've been talking about the issues that Vancouver is facing right now, the importance of activism, the relationship between social justice and education, and what it's like being a social justice organization on campus and situated in Point Grey. We're just closing this conversation, and if you are interested in learning more, you're about to hear Ishmael and Gabby give a little bit of information about how you can connect with the Social Justice Center and how you can begin to be involved in organizing and in activism here in Vancouver.
So we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, we have an email address, socialjusticecenter.ubc@gmail.com, and we are always open to folks who want to begin the work of organizing and want to join our community. You don't have to be a student at UBC, and we just want to encourage people to join the fight in the struggle for climate, housing, environmental, racial, and economic justice. These struggles are ongoing, but if we band together and we collectivize and we do our organizing in prefigurative ways, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and these worlds that we're envisioning, these worlds that we're building, are possible. And we just need to keep the faith. We are a kind community, and we welcome people who are new to organizing or extremely experienced. It doesn't matter. We're all learning, and we're all unlearning, and we're all in this process together. So we're online. You can reach out to us, and we'll definitely respond to you, and you're always welcome to join the SJC.
The other thing that I will very quickly plug, we do have this email template for sending emails to council to commit to funding the things that happened in the July motion. So it's an email template to send to City Hall or to the City Council to get folks to commit to deprioritizing policing and actually funding the motion to deprioritize police. I would also just say that we invite everyone and anyone in to join our collective imaginings and to join us in working to enact futures that are grounded in justice and in liberation and in solidarity and in community.
We are in the middle of a fight to remove the institution of policing from our communities. And there are bureaucratic steps that we have to get through in order for that to happen, unfortunately. We are kind of fighting for the city to reconstruct